Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Martin Amis's latest novel is his 15th work of fiction. Lionel Asbo's State of England centers around a thuggish yet occasionally endearing anti-hero, Lionel Asbo, whose last name results from being handed down at age 3 an antisocial behavior order, a civil order issued in Britain against conduct that includes things like begging, graffiti, and excessive noise. In contrast, Lionel's nephew Desmond is depicted as a working-class role model in his earnest pursuit of education and love. Amis is the author of such novels as London Fields, Money, and The Information, as well as the memoir Experience, two collections of stories, and 6 works of nonfiction, most recently, The Second Plane. It's a great pleasure to welcome Martin Amis to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
It's a great pleasure to have you with us. I have been a big fan of your work and have enjoyed this novel immensely.
Good.
What was it about this story, especially, and I don't want to read too much into the subtitle of State of England, but what is it that you wanted to ultimately explore?
I think I should have taken the advice of my then 12-year-old daughter, who said, "Enough with the subtitles, Daddy, for crying out loud," she said, with real passion. State of England was sort of meant to be a quiet subtitle, but it's had more play than is really salutary for this novel. I wasn't trying to do an analysis of Britain, but I did hope that it was a sort of tangential a look at Britain from a certain angle. And I was, you know, my feelings about England are, I hope, clear from the book. It's not written, as some people think, in disgust or in a valedictory sense, in that I've left England, but with affection for a place where I lived for half a century.
But very much about class, and I assume very much about many places dealing with money and class, and certainly correlations could be made to this country and elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. In England, it probably is unique in the depth of tabloid culture. We have 4 what we call red tops every day in Britain. And compared to any of those, the New York Post is like the Partisan Review. I mean, the level, and it's often charming and witty and, you know, punsome, but the, you know, deliberate vulgarity of those papers, it goes deeper into British society than it does here.
The characters certainly seem to be very keen and interested in what is in those pages, what is in those volumes.
Yeah, and well, they, especially when they're featured in them themselves. Is it the case here that, probably is, that that fame has become the equivalent of religion, more so in England because there's no religion, unlike here. And it's as if celebrity is a right, is a democratic right that all British people should enjoy. And not being famous is seen as a kind of deprivation.
Would you have had any problem with being deprived?
I don't think I would. I mean, the catch is that it comes with the job, in that your novel is competing for the interest of people against many, many other rival appeals to their interest. So you have to get a readership, which is what it's all about, you have to be conspicuous. But if I could have done it without being conspicuous, I would have done.
There is often criticism about, and I don't know why this is often attached to you, and perhaps it has more to do with the British tabloid culture and just not something I understand, but if you write a book like this about a lower class that in somehow you were being disingenuous?
That's come up as a criticism in England, and it astonished me because I've been doing this for 40 years without being challenged. I've always had working class characters in my novels, sometimes main characters in my novels. And it's a search for self-righteousness wherever you can find it. That's what it is. And I think it's incredibly insulting to the working class to say that they should be ghettoized in fiction. I've written a novel in which one of the main characters was the King of England, Henry IX, in Yellow Dog. No one challenged me there. It's a sort of tremendously contemptuous and patronizing idea that you can only write about your own class. And it's not true, as the example of so many writers proves.
What is it about class specifically that you wanted to explore with primarily these two characters of Desmond and Lionel?
I'm not sure it is a question of class. The class system was hugely present when I was growing up, and impossible not to be aware of it 20 times a day. The boundaries have loosened. There is what we call an underclass, and what used to be called the residuum, and a more or less circumambient middle class. That's the great divide. But, you know, in Jane Austen's time, to get from trade to minor gentry would take five generations. Now all you need to do is win the lottery.
And win a lot of money and realize ultimately that while the trappings change, the situation doesn't really change. The person doesn't.
No, you just go to court in nicer cars.
And the character of Desmond, who is the nephew of Lionel, is a fascinating character because he has had a very troubled life. His mother passed at a very young age. He's having relations with his grandmother at the beginning of the novel.
She's only 24 years older than him, though, remember?
Yes.
I know. Yes, go on. Sorry.
But it's a fascinating character because he obviously has his own troubles, but they pale in comparison to that of his uncle, who is, for all practical purposes, the father figure.
Yeah. Well, you know, am I patronizing the working class by having the character of Desmond, who is the most idealized character I've ever created? In fact, it was a novel challenge for me to create someone so good, because it's axiomatic in fiction that the nice characters don't come off the page. It's always the villains and the eccentrics who live most vividly in fiction, and they're the ones we like, as John Updike said. The values, the moral reckoning you have with these characters has nothing to do with how much you would value them in real life. What we like is vigor, and those characters have it more obviously than the goodies.
Were you thinking Dickens and Great Expectations upon
writing this? I don't think I ever thought of Great Expectations, but I was constantly thinking of Dickens. And many of the characters' names and the street names are taken from Dickens. Mm. And I didn't realize how profoundly the Dickensian influence was with me until I was finishing the novel. And I realized that the novel is the same genre as much of Dickens, in that he confused literary criticism for decades by not being a social realist. Clearly a great writer, but people couldn't tell whether he was a serious writer. And they couldn't get over the fact that he wasn't like George Eliot, Trollope, etc., Jane Austen even. He is not a hardcore social realist. He is a fantasist. His novels have more in common with the Disney cartoon than with the responsible fiction of Victorian fiction. And my novel, too, is like that. Semi-magical twists, huge rewards, huge punishments, everything slightly exorbitant and inordinate. And that is Dickens.
I read a review before I read the novel, and it was a description and referring to it as a social satire. And it wasn't until I finished the novel that I realized how off base that was. And then I saw in an interview that you gave of referring to yourself as an ironist and not a satirist.
Well, I satire is, you know, it was once fetchingly defined as being militant irony, i.e. the satirist has intensified the irony to the point where he hopes to provoke anger and he hopes to provoke change, social change, to deal with the difficulties he's satirizing. I don't think that's very useful. Novels don't change the world unless it's through an accident of history, like George Eliot's Daniel Deronda, which was the most influential novel of the 19th century, simply because it pointed the way towards Zionism and actually did bring about change. But that is kind of a fluke. The only change that a novel brings about is in the mind of a good reader. Novelists are all in the education business, basically, and what they hope to do is not increase the knowledge of their readers, but increase the receptivity of their readers, so that when your reader goes out into the world having read your novel, it's slightly richer perceptions, a richer response, and that's the only change you can bring about.
I find that fascinating. How would you describe, or how do you vision a good reader?
One who doesn't bring to the novel any kind of ideology, do not come to a novel with all the anxieties of you know, your group. Again, don't identify with the characters. As when I taught English, I taught novels. I used to say to them, you know, when you read Pride and Prejudice, don't identify with Elizabeth Bennet or Fitzwilliam Darcy. Identify with Jane Austen. And the good reader will be always identifying not with the characters, but with the author. That's it. That's the good reader.
With that said, does that make it so that there are people that who would read your novel that get you, and people who don't?
Yeah, and what you're hoping for is a response from the reader that is similar to your response to your favorite writers. And there's a special frisson that goes through you when you read for the first time a writer who you know is going to be important to you and whose stuff you will probably read in its entirety. That's the devoted kind of reader that you prize most.
When you think of the reader who thinks of you, the writer, and thinks of Martin Amis as they are reading the novel, do you think that they have come along with you, that they, like your work, have been on a journey of sorts?
I think that's very true of my contemporaries. If they have been reading me, then we have all been on this journey. But I'm more and more fascinated and excited by attracting young readers, because it's shameful to admit, but writing, like most forms of, you know, aspiration, are at one level a quest for immortality. Love of fame, said Milton, meaning this immortality, posthumous fame, that last infirmity of noble mind. It's the last sin you give up. But you do have it, and it's why you put your passion into writing. So when I see a young reader, someone of 25, I think if I drop dead now, then I'm going to live on in him or her for at least another, you know, 50 years. And it had never occurred to me before, and it's very heartening.
That you have this body of work that we can follow.
Well, that you're attracting young readers who you know will sort of take you forward even after you're dead. I used to talk about this with my father, and he said posterity is not going to be any bloody use to me, he said, because I'm going to be dead. But I think posterity is a good goal, and it's nicely managed to keep you honest, because you are going to be dead when it sort of takes effect, and you're never going to know it for sure, and you're never going to feel the benefits of it. But that makes it even more worth aspiring to.
But as a result, even though indeed your father, Kingsley Amis, was dead, it was ultimately you that had to deal with the posterity.
Yeah, and when there was that huge fuss about Philip Larkin, and you remember for a decade his reputation was destroyed. It's restored now, pretty much. Simply because when his letters were published, all the sort of racist snarls and the misogynistic snarls, of which there were, you know, a considerable number, I think easily overlooked. Because, again, as my father said, what you write in a letter is never your last word on any subject. It's you know, reflecting your mood. So I said, when your letters come out, which they did posthumously, I said to my father, it's going to be even worse, isn't it? And he said, yeah, well, you'll have to deal with that because I won't be around. But in fact, I was delighted to see that there is absolutely nothing in his letters that that caused any embarrassment or controversy, except how sort of brilliant they were and how energetic.
Do you ever go back and read your father's work?
Yeah. I read The Old Devils again just a few months ago. And that is his greatest book, I think. And it was such a pleasure.
Is it a learning experience?
I can... When I very much identify with the author. And whenever I read, I'm always thinking, are you sure you sort of brought that off, that bit? Or that's stunningly... You know, it fills me with incredulous admiration that you brought that off. But I can see... When I read my father, perhaps more than with any other writer, I can see where he's sort of got himself into a corner a bit, and his less successful novels, I keep thinking the focus isn't sharp enough, that kind of thing. And I associate it with certain times in his life and certain difficulties in his life.
Do you have the perspective to do that with your own work?
No, and I find I'm less and less interested in my what I've already written. I like my more recent novels much more than my early novels. That's as it should be, I hope. But as time shrinks, as the future diminishes, it gets smaller all the time, I want to press on, and I don't like to go back. And even checking the proofs of your most, you know, immediate predecessor novel, it is a chore, to put it no higher, because your forward momentum gets greater as you get older, funnily enough.
In reading that draft, especially with you, because there is such humor in all of your work, and this novel is hilariously funny in parts. Can that humor and that comic timing be halted at all?
Well, the example I obviously look to is my father, and he never lost. His comic drive did weaken, as all your energies weaken. There's no two ways around that. But the desire to give delight is what makes a writer write. And... if you're a comic writer, then you very much want to make people laugh. And it, I I can't imagine. I'm writing a novel, a short novel about the Holocaust, and I will not. I refuse to deny myself some bitter mockery there. You know, no subject is entirely insulated from humor, and I would always, as I'm a great believer in the pleasure principle, that you write to give pleasure and you read to gain pleasure, and that irony and even comedy is a part of that.
And in the specific act of rereading what you have just written, so when you finish Lionel Asbo and you read the draft, are you concerned about going at it again, that humor, that irony could be lost if you take a second, third, or fourth crack at it?
Good question. And you know, the great critic Northrop Frye said that there does come a point where the book will go dead on you, and you'll just be out of anxiety and vanity. You will be trying to shape it to come across in a more attractive way, and you should let it go, he said. And Northrop Frye said, and if the thing is alive, it will scream to be separated from the feeding tubes and navel strings of your ego. It's the ego that suddenly swells at that point. But, you know, they do need to be looked at again. And with Lionel Asbo, I had the novel and unpleasant experience of coming to the end of the first draft and thinking it only needed a polish. This is after a year's work on it. And then the revision took another year. That's how I'd missed the mark. It came quickly, and when things come quickly, you tend to be perfunctory. And I had to go back and bring it all up to a certain standard, and had to do my suffering, because a novel should be half joy and half suffering, and I'd done the joyous bit, and then I had to do the suffering.
And is there joy now, knowing that you got it right?
Yeah, and that lasts for a few months, and I do like looking at it now. It's just about wearing off, but it is very. It looks impressively convincing when it's in hardcovers, and those phrases you struggle with in your chaotic notebook are suddenly there, and you're often, you know, agreeably surprised and impressed by how good it looks.
You mentioned earlier this year moving to this country and from England. Do you want to write about America? Is that something that you're thinking about?
It wasn't part of my plan, and I always thought that by now you're not much affected by where you are. But this was a conclusion I reached prematurely when living in Uruguay. We were there for 3 years, and although I loved the country and loved the people, adored the people, I thought I wouldn't write about Uruguay, and I probably never will. But America's different, because I lived here as a child and I speak the language. I know the rhythm of America, of American speech. And, you know, part of the motive for coming here, it was nearly all family stuff. Mm-hmm. And hoping that Christopher Hitchens, my best friend, would have lived a little bit longer than he did. But I did feel that a change of landscape might inspire something in me. Not that I feel short of things to write about. And I'm getting an awful suspicion that I will be writing a New York novel after this one I'm finishing now.
And this novel is dedicated to Christopher Hitchens, we should note. The new novel is Lionel Asbo, State of England. It is published by Knopf. Martin Amis, what a great pleasure and treat to have you on our program. I thank you very much for being with us.
I've enjoyed it too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. This show was recorded at the Radio Foundation in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.